Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Keeper Cup podcast. I'm Chad Young, joined as always by Pete Ball. Happy New Year. Last we talked to you, it was still 2023. It's now 2024. Exciting year. We're getting close to spring training, just weeks away. I'm ready. I think especially because the hot stove has been kind of slow. Although we're recording this on Sunday morning, and it was just announced that the Mets have signed Sean Manaea. That's about the biggest news we've gotten recently. Things are just sort of crawling along, and so I'm like, all right, let's get some baseball going.
Yeah, man, totally. I'm fortunate. Like, if you really need to scratch the itch, and you're allowed to do this in your state, I highly recommend an NFBC 50's 4-hour draft. Because I've had the itch for over a month now, and I am just in the middle of my second draft. That's how long these things take. And it lets you really sit down. It gets you deep in the weeds. I mean, the last pick in this draft that I'm currently in was, it's got to be somebody, D.L. Hall went in the 34th round. So I'm deep in the weeds, ready to go here. I highly recommend NFBC 50s. It's a draft and hold 4 hours. That'll scratch the itch and hold you over for some time.
Yeah, I can't do those things in my state, but I have been working on my 2024 Fangraphs points rankings, and that's like it's a process to go through. I'll tell you, and I know I need to add players to this because there's some players who aren't in the Auto New universe yet that I need to look at, like Yuki Matsui, the Korean reliever that San Diego
Usuko.
He's not in there yet. Imanaga's not in there yet because he hasn't signed yet. So I've got a few names I still have to add, but I have a ranking. It's right now. It's a very rough ranking of 849 players for Fangraphs points. We're going to talk about that a little bit later in the episode. We're not going to go through all 849. Maybe we'll look at the top 20 or 25 or something like that. I will tell you, the way I cut the data was I took the Auto New universe and took every player who's rostered in at least 3% of leagues or who was picked up in any of there's been a couple of Auto New mock auctions that have happened, the one that we talked about before, but there's another one going on. Anyone who's picked up in one of those auctions, anyone who has a value on the surplus calculator. And then a few weeks ago when we talked inflation, we had Adam on, and he has a values sheet he shared with me. And so anyone who has a value in that, like, I was just like, that's me, my universe of players. One of the names that's on there is Wander Franco. And so he is number 849 on my rankings right now. He's dead last. Just, I don't want him. I don't think he's ever going to play baseball again. So he's at the bottom. We won't talk about anyone else between about 50 and 848 because they're not interesting. But before we get into that, we have a few other topics to cover. The first of which is our regular discussion of jersey numbers. This is episode 123, I believe. And that's so right. Jersey number 23. This is an interesting one. I mean, the top end of this is Hall of Fame caliber names, but not necessarily elite inner circle Hall of Fame caliber names. And some of these guys aren't guys who wore the jersey every year. Zach Greinke has not worn it every year of his career. He wore it for 10 years, but he is number one in Baseball Reference WAR to have worn this jersey. Ryan Sandberg, he's second, another like Hall of Famer, but not necessarily inner circle Hall of Famer. Louis Tiant wore it for 11 seasons. I'll let you weigh in with who you want, but I'm going to drop down pretty far down this list, actually, to a guy who's got about 34 career WAR, so about half as much as those guys at the top.
I know who it is.
Just retired. And I think deserves at least a shout out for retiring, because he would have had a pretty solid dollar value in my rankings this year. And that's Michael Brantley. And Brantley, I mean, just the definition of a professional hitter throughout his career, really, really highly respected and regarded player among his peers. Someone pointed out to me like his projected steamer projection WRC plus for this year is 118. So this isn't a guy who's retiring because he can't cut it anymore. Last year was a down year for him, but BABIP had a lot to do with that, and he was injured. He barely played, right? Like, so maybe he's too hurt. Maybe he can't come back. But this is a guy who, if at least if you ask the projection systems, it's like, dude, if you can get out there and play 100 games, you're going to hit the cover off the ball just like you always have. And so going out, maybe not quite on top, but near a point where he's still just, no. He's the kind of guy, like, he was 36 last year. He seemed like the kind of guy who at, like, 53 years old would be like, yeah, I can go out and hit 300. No problem. So Michael Brantley gets my shout out. I don't know if there's anyone else you want to mention, but that's the guy who stood out to me.
No, yeah, I'm definitely cool with this being the Michael Brantley episode, 5-time All-Star, which was more than I thought, Silver Slugger. Yeah, I think it's ultimately injuries. I can't remember, was it a shoulder issue that he's been dealing with over the last year or so, or something like that? But it's been something that's clearly brought an awesome career to, I don't want to say an abrupt end because he had a long career, but certainly an end.
Yeah, I mean, retiring it at 36, he'll be 37 in May. Like, that's not some crazy young age. It's not like he's, you know, 28 and it's over, but it does feel like it could have gone on a little longer. He did say in his statement, like, hey, it's time to, like, spend time with my family and not miss milestones with my kids and stuff like that. And so I was like, you know, especially guys that I respect, that I like, that I enjoyed as players, like, I like seeing them be like, you know what, I'm ready, I've got other things I want to do. It's always nice when guys can retire on that instead of it being like, you know, every once in a while you see these guys retire where they're like, oh, I feel like I have more to give, but I'm not finding the right opportunities and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I don't know, just walk away when you want to walk away. It feels like that's what Brantley's doing. So good for him. Enjoy your retirement, Michael. At least for, you know, he's also a guy who, like, anytime a player leaves a team, there's, like, groups of fans who are like, oh, screw that guy, I can't believe he left. He's one of the few guys that, like, he left Cleveland and I haven't heard a single Cleveland fan, other than some, like, grumbling about Houston, right? Because nobody wants anyone in Houston. But other than that, like, people are not, I haven't seen any sign of Cleveland fans being upset with him, bitter with him. Like, he gave us a good decade of great baseball in return for a few months of CC Sabathia. And hard to argue with what he did while he was here. So, yeah, enjoy your retirement, Michael. With that, Pete, we should dive into our topics for the day. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit about first-year auctions, startup league auctions, and I am trying to find my email because we got an email from a listener. I will say we do have an email, keepercut@gmail.com. I am really bad at looking at that, so, like, don't ask me timely things on there because I might miss it. But we did get an email a couple days ago from Ethan Hunt. Ethan also pinged me on Discord and said, you know, there's a handful of pitcher list members starting, or at least trying to start, he says, an auto new league this year. Wondering if y'all could spend a few minutes on the next Keeper Cut talking about how to approach the auction for a new league. And he points out, like, I've done snake drafts for redraft. I have, like, this is new to Ethan, which is great. First of all, Ethan, you're making a good decision. The transition from, you know, snake draft, redraft leagues to auto new, or really to any keeper league and to auctions is a good one. I'm glad you're doing it. Good decision. But Pete, I think there's probably two different things we should talk about here. One is prepping for the auction, which is really what he asked, but they're also trying to get a league started. Why don't we talk a little bit first about what you do when you're starting up a league? What are the things you consider? And specifically for Auto New, I mean, you and I have started some leagues together, but have you ever started an Auto New league without me leading it?
No, I'm still just in four, and one of the teams I never even, I co-manage that, and I just let my buddy just do whatever. I can't name one player on the team. So I'm really just in three and just the two startups.
The two startups you've been under are the Podcaster League that we started last year, the Listener yep. League that we started, what, 2 years ago, 3 years ago? And then you're in the Fangraph Staff League.
Yep. The White Whale.
Yeah, what's your fourth one?
It's the Pitcher List League.
Oh, Pitcher List, right.
Yeah, I have no pulse on that. My buddy Chris, who I've been playing fantasy baseball with for a long time, he's a really smart dude, and he does a nice job. But man, I'm not firing shots. All I know about that league is the trade offers I receive because they go to my email and like, yeah. Oh my God. Like, I don't know if they think Chris is dumb, but woof, I have received some absolute doozies in that one.
Yeah, it does happen in any league that happens. So is that a Fangraphs points league? Do you even know?
It's an old school 5x5.
Okay. So you're in 2 5x5s, 1 4x4, and then you're in a head to head Fangraphs points.
Yeah.
Sound right? Okay. Yeah. So I think actually, you know, Ethan, that's the first thing that you and your league mates need to figure out is there are four ways of scoring, but there's actually like six, there might even be more ways of setting up a league because you can do 4x4. And for those, like, as long as we're talking starting new leagues, for anyone out there who hasn't done Auto New, 4x4 is the original Auto New format. It is home runs, runs, on base, and slugging for hitters. It is ERA, whip, strikeouts, and home runs per nine for pitchers. So it is a saber metric friendly roto format. So that's one format. There is old school 5x5, which is exactly what you expect it to be. I'm not going to list all those categories. You all know them. And then there's Fangraphs points and there's saber points. Fangraphs points and saber points both use linear weights for offense, and it's the same scoring for offense. You can go to the Auto New FAQ page and see the details on that. For pitching, the basic difference is saber points is purely FIP based. It's strikeouts, walks, home runs. There's also some points for wins and saves, for holds and saves in order to give relievers sort of fair value. But it is purely like balls in play are not the pitcher's responsibility, whereas Fangraphs points does give pitchers some penalty for allowing hits. Those are the four formats that are out there. But you can also pick if you're going to do in the points formats, you can do season long or head to head. You can decide whether or not you want playoffs, and that includes, by the way, I am pretty sure you could do like a 4x4 league and then do a head to head playoffs if you wanted. It'd be really weird because you're then changing formats for the month of September, but
I don't like
someone out there's probably doing it. Yeah. But I think that the first thing you need to do is decide which of those you want to do. I mean, Pete, having done three roto leagues, one points league, do you have a preference among those formats, or at least the ones you played?
Yeah. So, I mean, my history is head to head categories. Like, that's what I broke into fantasy baseball with. I think everybody's got sort of their similar. Whatever you went in with, that's probably what you like to play. But Auto New was so foreign to me when we started this podcast that I kind of liked just jumping right in with Fangraphs points and like really just getting a whole new brand experience. I wasn't somebody who enjoyed points. I don't like the ESPN, which is sort of like my home application system for points. It's weird to me. So everything was new and I liked that. I would say, like, if you're a seasoned fantasy player and you're brand new to Auto New, it doesn't, and I know this was the idea behind the Podcasters League, or at least I think it was, because everything is new, it might make sense to just start with 5x5 old school, and that way you can kind of get a feel for how a $400 budget works, you know, how the auction system works and all that kind of stuff, how arbitration works, and get a feel for the general structure and layout of Auto New. And you don't have to worry about the scoring. Like, you kind of already have an idea of the value of the players going into it, because the value of a lot of these players changes drastically from format to format, particularly that 4x4. Man, that I said this last year, I was still not really used to that scoring. It's because I play so many damn leagues that, like, home runs per nine is just like, that's a crazy, it's a good category. I'm not against it, but it's like a crazy one for me to adjust to when it comes to building my pitching staff. So it's my long-winded way of saying maybe go for 5x5, get used to Auto New, and then jump into some of the other formats.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I think, like, there's, you know, I remember I had someone once gave me advice in a job that, like, if you're changing jobs, changing roles at your job, like, you want either more responsibility or more difficult responsibility, you want a new subject area, you want a new location, you want a new manager, but you don't want to change all those things at once. Sure. Because it just becomes overwhelming, and it sort of fits here too. I personally 4x4 is my favorite of the auto new formats. And so I think even if you're used to 5x5, I think going to 4x4 is a little bit of a better experience, in my opinion, but it's still roto and you still sort of used to that. Points is where the most content exists for auto new. So like the surplus calculator does do all formats, but there's just more focus, I think, on points leagues in the community because it's the most, Fangraphs points is the most played format. So there's lots of choices there. I do think, like, if you've only ever played 5x5 and you're like, how do I jump into this new thing? 5x5 is definitely a good place to start. A lot of the other settings you'll walk through as you sign up around, like, do you want, I think there's like a choice of like 24 or 48 hours for trade review. I would always suggest 24 hours. Leagues rarely need 48 hours to decide if a trade should be vetoed. But there's some other things that, like, I think you are worth talking about as a league. There's a rule, it's rule 1A. If you go look at the rules that say you have to have a sort of a full MLB roster, and there's no sort of forced enforcement of that. So in theory, a team could cut all their MLB players, sign a bunch of prospects, and you have to decide how you feel about that. It is worth discussing that as a league and being like, oh, do we think this is a good idea, bad idea? How are we going to enforce this? In general, what I found is that when leagues discuss something like that, everyone's like, everyone comes to an agreement of what to do, and then you never have to enforce it because people are generally not terrible and they don't just break rules for the sake of breaking rules. But it's worth having that conversation. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that you really need to do as you're getting started. I think those are sort of the biggest things. The other thing I would do, and this will get into our draft, we can use this to transition to auction strategy, but that first year auction, I mean, Pete, you've now done two of those first year auctions. They are time consuming, we'll say.
Oh yeah.
And I know for both of the startups we've done, we did the same structure where we did like, what did we do? Like 3 hours of live auction. Not live, like in person, live on the auto new system, but like players being nominated, 15 seconds to bid, clock reset, right? Like the standard fantasy auction like you'd expect. And then after 3 hours, we switched to a slow auction using couch managers, which, we've talked about on the show before how those slow auctions work. If you got questions about it, let me know. I've also written about that on Fangraphs. You can go look for that on Fangraphs. What that basically does, it allows us to make sure that the biggest name players, the highest priced stars are auctioned in sort of a traditional setting without then having to spend like 8 hours in auction together. So I think that's a really good way to do a startup. The other way to do it is to pick two separate days and do like 3 hours on each of those days and then switch to either slow auction or using in-season 48 hour auctions that Auto New has, for normal free agent pickup. So there's just a couple of different ways to do that. And I would spend at least a little bit of time thinking through how you're going to schedule that, because it can be a significant amount of time. Pete, how have you felt that that's worked doing that format?
I prefer the way that we've done it based on the different ways of doing it that you just described. I really enjoy drafting and doing auctions. That's why here in, early January, I'm already two drafts deep. And so you kind of get to scratch that itch. You also get a lot more time to like think about your roster. You go through that 3 hour experience that it kind of goes by quick because number one, it's something that you enjoy if you're doing this. But number two, like the players just come rapid fire. Like you said, 15 seconds, clock resets if there's a bid, and all of a sudden, your roster's starting to fill out. All the top names are going off the board. And after those 3 hours, you've probably got anywhere from, a quarter, maybe a third to a half a roster set. And you get to begin to think critically about what you want to do in the slow auction. So I really prefer it that way. Just having the ability to kind of think about your team before finishing it and making all those rash decisions for your bench and filling out your weak spots.
Yeah, and that, like I said, that does get us into a transition into the strategy question for first-year auctions, which is really what Ethan was asking. But before we dive too deep into that, let's take a quick break, and we'll get into that when we come back. All right, welcome back. We were talking about first-year auctions, and we've been talking a little bit about how to get an auto-new first-year auction set up, what the structure should look like. Now we're going to get into strategy a little bit, and interestingly, at least for me, these things are related in that what you were just saying is exactly what I would do in a split auction. Whether split means you're doing 3 hours today and 3 hours next week, or you're doing 3 hours today and then you're doing a slow auction or whatever. In those cases, I rarely go into the first portion with a very detailed plan. I have some guys I like. I have some, you know I want to walk away with at least a couple of star players, right? So I might have an idea of like, I want to find a couple of $40 players and a $30 player. But like, other than that, I'm like, eh, let's just see how things go. We'll see where the values are. And then when there's that break, either because you're going to do 3 more hours next week or because you're going to switch to slow auction or whatever, that's where I sit down and start to like build out a depth chart and be like, okay, what didn't I get? What do I still need? Where can I spend? Who are the right free agent targets? Is that, I mean, do you go in with more of a plan in the first half than that?
I think I do towards the end, because the thing I worry about with slow auctions is if I have a deep sleeper that I like, and I'm going to give a bad example because number one, he wasn't like amazing last year. And number two, I don't even know if this is what I did for this particular league, but Carlos Estevez is just the name that's sticking in my mind. And last year I liked him as a purely just saves target. I thought the Angels bullpen was kind of trash. And this was a guy who they were bringing in who like, all right, at the very least, he's going to provide saves. And to his credit, that is what he did. His ratios were not outstanding, but he certainly didn't kill me. And by the way, it's hard to find saves in 5x5 Otnu. There's just so many relievers that are rostered. Yeah. It is very hard to find saves. So my issue with waiting to nominate a player like that for the slow auction is that now I'm giving everybody else at least 12 hours to think about, do they want this guy or not? Whereas if I wait a little bit and we're in the immediate, you know, the 3 hour auction, 15 second timer, at the live auction, I guess would be the way to put that. I'm kind of forcing people to make a decision. And I think a lot of people look at Carlos Estevez and be like, I think I can find saves elsewhere. And all of a sudden now he's $6. That makes me a little uncomfortable. Whereas if I let him go to slow auction, people might be like, you know, I'm also looking at that Angels depth chart and I kind of do need saves more than I thought. And now I have time to look through the available relief pitchers and man, there really isn't a lot of saves left. So I don't know if I actually did nominate Carlos Estevez during the live portion last year, but if I were doing a startup now, those sleepers that like I really want, that I feel really strongly about, I kind of want to force people to make a decision quicker because I don't want to give them time to research that player. But otherwise, in terms of like immediate strategy, I mean, we could talk more about this, Chad. I'll let you respond to that. But I certainly had my targets last year.
Yeah, I actually like, I don't think I've always been great about that in startup auctions. I do that in, like, I'm pretty good about that in future years where I'm like, okay, it's year four. I know I need this thing. I think I sometimes in a startup, I'm not always as well prepared around like, what am I going to need? Right. I know in a 5x5, you know, there's 10 categories. I know I need those 10 categories, but I think you're right to think ahead and say like, man, you know, second base is going to be hard to fill and saves are going to be hard to come by. And so like, who are the guys I can nominate in the first half of the draft? Before, like I said, before everyone else maybe realizes what they're worth. I really like that idea. I think it's a really smart strategy. I would do that if I were, I would be more proactive about doing that in the future if I were doing a startup league this year. Typically what I do, like I said, I tend to have more of a sense of like, I know I need a couple of star players to carry my team because if you don't have those guys, it's really hard to win. But I tend to be a value drafter. And so what I'm going to do for that draft is I'm going to go in with my list of values, how much I'm willing to bid on players. And I'm going to just, for those first 3 hours, whatever it is, I'm going to sign the guys who fit my budget, right? I'm like, oh, this guy's a $40 player and he's only at 35. I'll bid on him. This guy's a $50 player and he's at 41. I'll bid on him. I especially like that when there is that break before you switch to a slow auction or before you go to a second day, because I can then say like, okay, these are the guys I got. What else do I need? If you're going to try to auction straight through, I mean, you're going to take some breaks because it's just too long otherwise. And so if you're going to auction straight through, I would have a plan for how you're going to use a 10-minute break to readjust. But to me early on, I think that's a smart strategy that you're talking about, to say like, okay, yeah, I'm just going to buy values. But in addition to buying values, I'm going to make sure I walk away with like two closers, and here's some closers I'm really interested in. And I want to fill second base. And because I'm scared of second base, I'm picking on second base today. I don't know why.
because historically it's been a terrible position. Yeah, it happens to be that this year it looks like it might be okay.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think, are there any other advice, any other strategies you'd recommend for somebody doing their first year on a new auction?
I get the last piece I'd leave people with, and I don't think this goes entirely against what you were just saying, because like you said, you need studs to win. And that is like, you know, at the beginning of the auction, it can be intimidating. Like, oh man, that guy just went for 60. This guy's pushing 70, whatever it might be. Don't be afraid to spend up for the players that you want, right? This has worked against me countless times, but last year it just happened to work out great. Where on my board, Acuna was not like the runaway number one. I hunted him down, might have overpaid, but in the end, obviously I didn't, right? I mean, he was clearly worth that. Yeah. It's not always going to work out that way, but in at least one of the mocks we did, I remember looking back and being like, man, I could have had another high-end player and still had money left over. I just don't want to be left with too much money left over after the auction thinking, wow, I could have added Yordan Alvarez to my roster and I just was too timid at the beginning. So now I don't have him.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I think I have that problem where I tend to be a value drafter. I tend to like, oh, this guy's getting so expensive. And I think sometimes you just got to get over that and go out and get guys. Because the reality is, especially in a first-year auction, right? In year four of a league where you've got keepers and your team is sort of formed and you're looking to fill out a roster rather than build a roster necessarily, sometimes you can, like, you know, I talked about this last year in that Fangraph staff league. Niv and I got too caught up in value drafting, left a bunch of money on the table, and didn't fill some needs we needed to fill. But we had a strong team to start with, and we were able to make a couple trades during the season and fill some stuff out, and we ended up winning that league. You can do that in those leagues. In a first year league, if you don't walk away from the auction with some guys who are going to carry your team at some level, like, you're in trouble right from the start. I think that's a great thing to keep in mind.
And like, you might be like, all right, I went $5 over to make sure I got Julio Rodriguez. Well, if to you, as the studied manager you are, if you're convinced that, you know what, Nick Senzel, I'm going to get him for a dollar and he's going to go 20-10 and he's going to be a $10 player, whatever. Well, there's your $9. Just trust yourself, trust your targets. Don't be afraid to spend. I do like the flexibility. Like you just brought up, you won that league with all that flexibility. It's not a bad thing, but too much. If you don't end up with a stud, like, I don't like that either.
Yeah. So with that, let's transition to another topic that's related to this. I think it's actually directly related to what we're just talking about, which is, who are those guys that if you were going into a first year auction right now, you would target? And I want to, the way I think about this, and Pete, you may think about it differently, and that's fine. But to me, this is not a, like, I don't go into this thinking like I need to get Juan Soto, right? Because the reality is, if I feel like I need a top tier outfielder, I could get Soto, I could get Judge, I could get Acuna, I could get Yordan. Like, I have options. I could even get, you know, J-Rod or Tucker or Carroll or someone like that, right? Like, so that's not where I focus on guys I need. It sounds like it's not either for you when you're talking about like Estevez. What I'm looking at is, who's a guy who, based on what they're likely to go for, I think is going to be a good value and allow me to spend somewhere else. And so I'll start off with this, because there are two names at the same position who I would be targeting in a startup league right now. And their first baseman, one is Josh Naylor, the other is Vinny Pascantino. Naylor is, just as an example, the two mock auctions that are going on. The Auto News Slack community had one that Pete and I participated in. There's another one going on right now. His average price in those mock auctions is $11.50. His projection is more like a $17 projection. And Pascantino is sort of in a similar camp where he's been going for about $11. His projection is anywhere from a $16 to $20 projection, depending on how you cut the data. Those are the kind of guys who, for me, from a bats perspective, I really like those guys. I think they're both good. Their values are down, I think, a little bit, or their perceived values, their market values are down a little bit for different reasons. But if I can get one of those two guys, I have filled either first base or util. It doesn't stop me if Matt Olson or Freddie Freeman or Pete Alonso or someone like that is a good value. It doesn't stop me from spending on a big first base bat because I can move one of the guys to util. But it allows me to put a $20 bat into my lineup right off the start without spending $20 on them. And so that's an area where, like, I really like to walk away with one of those two guys because they give me, I expect they will give me very, very valuable production at a low cost.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. Vinny P, clearly the injury bounce back target there. Josh Naylor, I do like a lot. And I agree. I mean, we could be talking about ultimately what would end up being a $20 player. I think the one stat that I keep coming back to with Josh Naylor is that he hit .299 against lefties last year. You know, and you can say what you want about batting average. It is one of our, well, not for points, but it is one of our typical 5x5 categories. And at the end of the day, the fact that he hit .299 against lefties, whether you put any stock in that or not, it does mean he's probably going to play more against lefties this season. I mean, Chad, you'd be our resident expert on this. I don't think Josh Naylor is a platoon player, right?
So this is so interesting to me because I don't remember if I was talking to you or someone else where I was just like, you have to be so careful with him because he's obviously a platoon guy, blah, 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 blah. And I went on and on about this. And then I pulled up his numbers and going into last year, I mean, his career WRC plus against left-handed pitchers is 84. Now, last year was only 147 plate appearances. So you've got to, be a little,
it's not nothing. It's actually for one season. Yeah,
sure. It's still a small sample, right? I mean, the reality is one of the reasons it's hard to evaluate things like platoon splits is you never really get enough data to know. But there are some pretty drastic changes in his platoon splits. In 2022, he was striking out 26.8% of the time against lefties, walking 11%. He was super passive. And that's sort of been fairly true for him historically. Stuff's been up and down. But last year, his strikeout rate against lefties was a career low 10.2%. His walk rate was 5.4%. That's a much lower walk rate. But it's a good sign that he was being more aggressive. He was going after the ball. He was also hitting more fly balls than he ever has in his career against lefties. He hit more line drives than he has every year except one. He wasn't popping the ball up at a high rate. He just, everything sort of looked good. Now, one of the big changes there is he was pulling the ball less, which is an interesting thing because we usually talk about, pulling the ball is good, right? That's how you hit home runs. That's how you hit for power. That's the thing that I want from Naylor, is somebody pulling the ball and smashing home runs. But it may be that against lefties, he's better off waiting a little bit, making sure he finds the pitch he wants, and if he needs to go the other way, going the other way. And the result was, like you mentioned, the .299 average. I mentioned 127 WRC plus against lefties. It wasn't just average. And the immediate thought is like, yeah, well, did he have BABIP luck? 308 BABIP. That's high for him, but it's not some crazy number. His home run per fly ball rate was 12.2%. That's not some crazy number. Like, there's nothing in here that you look at and you're like, dude, like this is not sustainable, except for the fact that it's only 147 plate appearances. And I'm hesitant to be like, he's fixed it. He can hit lefties now. But it is certainly enough that when the season starts, I expect him to be an everyday player.
Yeah, okay. Well, then there it is. If Josh Naylor really is, in fact, an everyday player and those things hold up, and as you were rattling off the stats, I'd be curious to hear him talk about it himself. It just sounds like the effort was, I just want to put the ball in play. I just want to put the ball in play against lefties and let that take care of itself. And that was definitely noticeable, not just in the fly ball rate or whatever it might be, that strikeout rate against lefties being at like 10% for a guy who would be labeled in years past as a platoon hitter. Like if he's only striking out 10% of the time, he's not a platoon player against lefties. Like just let him put the ball in play and see what happens. So yeah, I like the Naylor and Pasquantino picks there.
So what about you? Are there any bats that you look at that you're like, man, if I could walk out of, you know, the first part of that auction with this guy, it's going to really help me build my roster?
Yeah, so I thought a lot about this, and ultimately, it's not a particular player for me. And I'm not taking the cop out and saying that like every auction is going to be different. Like you're going to have your auctions where Corbin Carroll goes for 70. You're going to have your auctions where Corbin Carroll goes for 40. Like I'm not taking a cop out, but I view it more as tiers. More, and I haven't made my tiers yet. But to me, outfield as we know, we've talked about this quite a bit, is looking thin this season. Not new format means we're talking five outfielders and there's 12 teams. I mean, it's going to be hard to field a really good outfield. And so I'm looking at the elite outfielders and I want someone at the end of that tier. So for me, and obviously this would depend on format, if it's points, then guys like Michael Harris are not as useful. But if we went down NFBC rankings for outfielders, Acuña Jr., Julio Rodriguez, Corbin Carroll, Mookie Betts, Kyle Tucker, Fernando Tatis Jr., Aaron Judge, Juan Soto, Yordan Alvarez, stop. To me, there's a drop off after Alvarez. All those names I just gave, like some are definitely better than others, right? But I don't think it would be shocking if any of those guys finished as like the number one player in Fangraphs points. Like I just don't think it would be all that shocking. And that includes Alvarez, right? If he stays in the field for 150 games, why couldn't he finish number one? So to me, it's about waiting and making sure that my team ends up with maybe one of those guys. So in this case, I guess I'm saying Yordan Alvarez, which is a weird take because he's going to be expensive no matter what. But if all of those guys are gone and I get the cheapest of those outfielders, well, I'm feeling better positioned to strengthen my roster elsewhere. I do want to say this is only the case for first year auctions. I can't remember the exact players, but I remember last year in the Fangraphs staff auction, there was like a very clear, like four starting pitchers. It might've been five that were like, all right, these are like ace tier level pitchers. And as they started to go off the board slowly, I remember thinking like, all right, at least there's two left. All right, now there's this one left. I got to go for this one. I think that one was Julio Urias, who obviously had his issues last year, both on and off the field. It's kind of besides the point. But I wasn't the only one that was aware of that. And all of a sudden, Julio went for, he went in the 40s. After guys like Scherzer and a handful of others weren't even close to that expensive. So that's when waiting hurt. But I think in a first year auction, that's not as much of a concern. So I'd rather wait to the end of a tier. And in this case, go for Alvarez.
I think the challenge in a first year, in an auction, forget first year, subsequent year, the challenge in an auction versus a draft is like in a draft, if there are like five guys in a tier you want, you can wait till there are two left. And if your turn comes up, you can make a calculation and say, how likely are they both to fall, one of them to fall, whatever. And you can decide like, all right, I got to take my favorite of the two now, or I'm picking 10th. And so I have another pick coming up in three picks. I can pass on them now and get one on the comeback. Like you can make those kinds of calculations in an auction league. Just because a guy went last from a tier doesn't mean he's going to be cheapest from the tier. To your point on Urias. And I think that's actually a very common thing, even in first year auctions, that if you have eight teams that wanted one of the top six outfielders, or did you mention six outfielders, seven outfielders, whatever it is? You mentioned
12. I think it's 12. Yeah.
So let's assume you're in a league where everybody thinks they need to come away with one of those guys, and somebody comes away with two quickly. Then all of a sudden there aren't enough to go around, and whoever's last on that list might actually end up being the most expensive, which is what happened with Urias last year, because of just those market dynamics and the way things play out. So my take on that is not necessarily waiting. It's being opportunistic. I agree with you. Like if I look at it from, you know, I'm looking at my rankings for Fangraphs points right now, which we'll talk about a little later. And my top outfielders are Acuna, Soto, Judge, Alvarez, Rodriguez, Tucker, Carroll, Trout, Tatis, Schwarber. That might be where I stop, and maybe even above Trout, which leaves me with, like, you know, eight guys. If I want one of those eight guys, I'm not waiting for the last one. I am the first time one of those guys comes up and is going for a price I think is reasonable, I'm going to jump at it. And you run the risk then of being like, you know, three picks later, another guy gets nominated and he goes even cheaper. And you're like, wow, I should have gotten him instead. That to me, that's the better kind of hindsight than waiting till the last guy and being like, those guys were all going for 45 and the last guy went for 60. And now I've either missed out on all of them because I just could not get myself to go to 60, or I spent a ton on this guy when I could have spent a lot less than someone else. So I tend to prefer to, I shouldn't even say I tend to do this. My preference when I'm being logical about it is to jump in and get one of those guys when there's a reasonable price, even if it's a little high. I tend to be very bad at that. I want to wait for value. And because I want to wait for value, if I'm like, this is a $45 guy and he's going for 47, I pass. And then I end up with like, well, this guy's a $40 guy and he's already up to 50 and he's the only one left in this tier. And so what do I do? And that's how I ended up in the situation I did with Niv last year, where we bought nobody that we needed. And that's not a good situation either. So I agree with you. What the guy I want to end up with is whoever is cheapest from a tier. But in an auction setting, you don't know who's cheapest until the entire tier is gone. And that's much harder to judge. And so to me, it's more the first guy from a tier to get nominated and go for a good value. Just take them when you have the shot, especially in a first year auction where you have a full $400 budget. You can adjust and find someone else later.
Right. And yeah, I mean, that, and that's why I'm hesitant to even give a name here. Right. I like the way you put it. It's about being opportunistic and having in your head, like, all right, I want to end up with somebody here. So when I see a good value, that's what I'm going to pounce on. And it's not only not like a draft in that you can predict those things, but it's also not like a draft in that they're not going to necessarily be nominated in that order. Right. Like Alvarez, who's at the end of that tier. And by the way, it was nine names in my mind. Alvarez might get nominated first. Right. And then Jaron Duran might get nominated, and like, it's going to really muddy the waters and the values and everything else. So it is about being opportunistic. And that goes for all these players, not just the guys at the top. Right. I mean, if Vinny P gets nominated, all of a sudden the bidding gets up to $25. I'm sure you're out too. Right. So, I think that's where for sure I'm just being flexible and I'm targeting in my head. I mean, we'll talk about this when we get to starting pitcher in just a moment, a group of pitchers I want, a group of outfielders I want, and I'm going to be opportunistic within that range.
So who are the pitchers? Is it the same, just like I want one of the top 8-10 pitchers, whatever it is?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So if we're looking at the pitchers, and I again, I'm using NFBC ADP, which isn't always going to be the perfect carryover. Spencer Strider, Garrett Cole, Corbin Burns, Zach Wheeler, Kevin Gausman, Luis Castillo, Zach Gallen, and Stop. Talent-wise, I could certainly include Glasnow in there. I know a lot of people, including our fearless leader, Nick Pollock, would probably include George Kirby in there and have him even higher. I know there's a lot of hype on Pablo Lopez, but to me, Yamamoto, which I would not include in those seven names. That to me is
hearing his name come up there.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Those seven names, but again, it's about being opportunistic, because Zach Gallen might get nominated first and end up being the most expensive of that group. And the guy who ends up with, I don't know, Garrett Cole, which wouldn't happen, could end up with the best deal. So I just know in my head, going into a first-year auction, elite, high-caliber starting pitching is thin. Outfield is really thin. I don't want to miss out in these spots. So this is where I'm going to maybe be a little bit more aggressive than I would normally be.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And it's interesting because you and I do approach this from sort of a different direction, where you're looking at that top tier and saying, I need to get somebody from that tier. How do I plan around that? My approach is typically, and I'm going to, for pitchers, it's very similar to what I was saying with Naylor and Pasquantino. I am much more likely to go and say, who's a starting pitcher who I think might be a $15, $18, $20 starting pitcher who I think is going to go cheaper than that. That is, to be honest, much, much harder to do with pitching than it is for hitting. I found some hitters that I was like, you know, and I mentioned two of them, but I found some hitters I was like, yeah, this guy's projection is way better than what I'm going to have to pay for him. I haven't actually really found that pitcher. The closest I've come, and it's a weird situation, I think, is Carlos Rodon. And I haven't quite gotten myself to the point where I'm like, yeah, I want to walk away with Carlos Rodon as often as possible, especially in a first-year draft. But he still projects as like a $20 pitcher, and he's going for more like $10, $11. And I mean, here's the reality with Rodon. We know how good he is, or how good he can be, and we know he's been hurt and that that's the issue. And last year was terrible. Even when he came back, velocity seemed fine. Like, stuff seemed good, but the performance was not there. But if I look at the other guys who's like, looking again, those mock auctions that are going on, if I look at the other guys whose prices are meaningfully below their projections, it's like Rodon, Scherzer, who I'm not super excited about, Mason Miller, who's sort of all over the place, Shane Bieber is a little bit undervalued according to the projections, Chris Sale a little bit undervalued, and I just don't really, like, none of those guys jump out at me as like, yeah, I have to have that guy. And so Rodon is sort of the closest, which gets me back to, I think I'm looking at hitters where I can find undervalued hitters so that I can do what you want to do, which is spend on a top tier pitcher. Because I'm worried about what I'm going to get out of my pitching. And so, yeah, I would rather be in a position where I find two or three undervalued hitters, and then I can go after like a top of my rotation that's something like Gausman, Gallen, and Pablo Lopez, because I've just been willing to spend on all three of them. I think that's sort of the route I'm going to go this year.
Yeah, and you know, you said this right at the top, that your kind of strategy is obviously a tough, difficult one to do, and I think a lot of it has to do with the time in which they're nominated, right? Like, if you think you can get Carlos Rodon at a bargain, there's no way to predict this, but there's no way, if he's a target for me, I'm nominating him early in the draft when people have money and might think like, you know what, yeah, there's value there, I'll pay up for him as well. It's just a really tough thing to kind of plan out. I think part of the problem with starting pitching and why you probably had trouble finding one is like, we're in this weird place where you could maybe make the case that this is the case for starting pitcher every year, but the elite, like at the top is thinner than I think it usually is, or maybe it's almost too similar. It's weird. There's also a lot of names that are brand new to being in like the top 100 picks, the top 150 picks in drafts, which I know is often the case for pitching. It just feels like more this year. And we're looking at the top and like, Freddie Peralta, I mean, talk about a polarizing player, a player had two very different halves. He's basically like a top 15, top 20 starter. You know, Yamamoto, what are we doing there? Tarik Skubal, who like has all the skills, and I know you've been a fan of him for a long time.
Yeah.
Looked like he broke out last year, but do we really trust taking him as early as he's going? Apparently I do. I took him in that NFBC 50s I was talking about earlier that I'm in, but it's a weird state that we're in when it comes to starting pitcher. And so finding value is like, any of these guys could be valuable based on where they're going. I just want the closest thing to a sure thing that I can get.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I do think with pitchers early on, I'm with you on like a guy like Rodon. I think I want to wait, because what you don't want to do is if people be like, oh, there's a $20 projection here, I'll go to 15 because later in the draft they might not have money. The guy I might want to nominate earlier, the types of guys I might want to nominate earlier are to use the example of, you know, what Nick Pollock being really high on George Kirby. If I'm Nick, I'm nominating Kirby early because I want Kirby going at a time when everybody else is like, I'd prefer Gallen, I'd prefer Glasnow, I'd prefer Pablo Lopez. Framber is still out there, right? Like, what you don't want is to get to a point where Kirby's the best pitcher left and he's sort of the end of the tier guy. You want him to go early enough that everyone, if you think you're the high man on someone, you want them to go early enough that everybody else is like, eh, there's someone I like better still out there. You're not going to get like, you're not going to sneak him through for like $5 at that point, but you'll get him for a reasonable price instead of running the risk of, you know, the worst case scenario is there were four managers targeting him. All of them have lost their other options. And so now they are all banking on him. Somebody will way overpay. And so you want to avoid that if you can. Totally. With that, let's take a quick break again. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit of AutoNew rankings. All right, welcome back. Pete, I just emailed you a link to my draft AutoNew rankings. They are in process. I talked about this back at the beginning of the episode. I started with the entire AutoNew universe. I deleted anybody who was not rostered in any league. Sorry, who was not rostered in at least 3% of leagues or who wasn't nominated in any of the mock auctions that have happened so far, or who doesn't have a value on the surplus calculator, or who doesn't have a value in Adams rankings. Like, I took a bunch of things and tried to identify every player who might be worth looking at. I ranked 849 players. I do not want to talk about all 849. But let's look at my top 25. Let's say top 25. And I will read those off for the readers, listeners, so you guys can hear who they are. I'm sort of debating whether maybe I'm going to cut this off, actually. Let's do my top 20. And the reason I'm going to do my top 20 is because I break these guys into tiers. And I have my third tier. Is that my third tier? One, two. Yeah, my third tier ends at 20. So we'll cut it off there. Pete, you can see the guys after that if you want to talk about them. But here are my top three tiers of players. The first tier, which is a $55 to $65 tier, is Acuna, Soto, Judge, Betts, Otani, Yordan Alvarez, and that's it, those six guys. The next tier is actually even smaller. It's three guys from $45 to $54. That's Corey Seager, Freddie Freeman, and Spencer Strider. And then my third tier, which is $36 to $44, is Julio Rodriguez, Kyle Tucker, Corbin Carroll, Matt Olson, Mike Trout, Rafi Devers, Bryce Harper, Fernando Tatis Jr., Jose Ramirez, Jose Altuve, Vlad Guerrero Jr. Pete, that just dropped a bunch of names on people. You've got the list in front of you, so you can look at it. I guess my first question for you is, like, is anybody here just straight up in the wrong tier from your perspective?
I think the name that's almost boring to discuss because we've been doing this for years now is Mike Trout. Seeing him, you know, in your typical 5x5 drafts, and obviously his upside is pretty good in both, but he doesn't run anymore, so his upside is definitely higher here. Seeing him go in like the 70s, which, like, to me, that's a slam dunk pick. You know, like, if I'm picking up 76 and Mike Trout's there, I have a hard time not taking Mike Trout, especially given the aforementioned discussion about outfield. But I guess it's a tolerance thing, but I see beneath him Bryce Harper, Fernando Tatis Jr. There's no chance I'm paying more for Mike Trout nowadays, regardless of the fact that he could be, you know, he could be a $75 player. When was he last?
Yeah,
that's ultimately my question. And at some point, you know, he's got, what was it, a back thing that's apparently chronic, and he says he's fine, and I'm not trying to drop conspiracies and everything else, but the dude can't stay in the field. Like, yeah, all right, he got hit in the hand or whatever it was, and that's just bad luck, but, like, okay, add it to the list. And I think at this point, especially if it's a head-to-head points league, I want someone who's probably going to be there for me in the playoffs, and I'd just much rather have, like, Trout or Tatis Jr.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, those guys, I have them all in that same
tier,
$36 to $44 tier.
Yeah.
Would you drop Trout out of that tier down to, like, I wouldn't go over $35 for him? And, you know, leaving inflation aside and league dynamics aside, like this is a startup league. Is he more in that $28 to $35 tier for you?
Right. I guess that's really the question here. Yes, he is. And honestly, like knowing me, like I couldn't put him in the $21 to $27 tier because that's basically just putting up the white flag and saying, I'll never have Mike Trout.
Yeah. Right.
But is he that different than Kyle Schwarber now when it comes to this format and scoring? Like, I don't know. And then you factor in the injury risk. Well, then I'm definitely out. Like, I feel like not to go too down a rabbit hole with Kyle Schwarber, but like last year for his batting average, that felt like a worst case scenario. Like, I'm not saying he's going to ever bat for a high batting average, but the dude was batting under 200. Like, come on. I think I'd rather Schwarber feels more bankable to me. And Trout, for that much money, like you're tying up so much of your team into this player that I just don't think he can stay healthy. So yeah, I would lower him a tier to answer the original question, because we're nitpicking versus Harper and Tatis.
Yeah.
I would lower him a tier at least.
Is there anyone you would move up a tier? Looking at, and you I mean, for listeners, my next tier, I can read it off quickly, is it's a little bit longer, but Gerrit Cole, Austin Riley, Bobby Witt Jr., Pete Alonso, Trey Turner, Marcus Semien, Kevin Gausman, Corbin Burns, Kyle Schwarber, Zach Gallen, Tyler Glasnow, Framber Valdez, Pablo Lopez, Yoshinobu Yamamoto, and that's it. That's that next tier. Anyone from that tier that you're like, dude, he needs to be moved up?
Yeah, so I want to remind everybody that's listening, especially if you're this deep into the podcast, then you are aware of this. But when you hear that Bobby Witt Jr. is ranked that low, that is because this is FanGraphs points that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Bobby Witt is going as the number two player on NFBC, so it just looks weird. And I'm actually not going to say to move him up. I want to see more of an improvement on that walk rate. A lot of his value in 5x5 is obviously tied up in the fact that he's a 50 stolen base stealer, which doesn't matter as much here. Trey Turner, I think I'd still pay up for. I think that's what I'm going to end up doing in the staff league, where it's a little bit different because, you know, this isn't a first year auction. This is a league that's been around. But I have Trey Turner there right now it's probably right in this range. I have him for $43, which is like, that's an expensive Trey Turner. And according to this, he probably should be a cut. But given the second half that he had, given the history that this player has had, and shortstop gets kind of weird. It does. Like if you wait too long on shortstop, it can get kind of weird on you, where you're looking at it and you're like, wait a second, do I really want Carlos Correa to be my shortstop? So he's a guy who I don't know if he should move up a tier, but I'm looking at that range from $28 to $35, and I'm thinking like this is a player who's at the top of that range for me. So he might be closest. And then, of course, you know, the conversation about elite starting pitching. You have a lot of high-end starting pitchers in this range. Now, part of that might be their propensity for the long ball. But, like, I don't know. Kevin Gausman, Corbin Burns, these are top five starters to me. And they're not in the first or second tier. So maybe they're not moving up for me like Trey Turner, but they're guys I'm going to pay at the top of this tier for.
Yeah, I think that is more about how I view pitching, right? And they maybe should be higher in that tier. Cole, I mean, you say they're top five starting pitchers. They're in my top five, right? My top starting pitchers are Strider, who I have ninth in that $45 to $54 tier. He's the only guy in that second tier. Gerrit Cole, I have down at 21st overall. He's my number two pitcher. And then Gausman at 27, Burns at 28, Gallen at 30, Glasnow at 31. Like that's one through six, right? So it's not that I have them lower among my starting pitchers. Mm-hmm. It's, I think, especially as we move to a world where, and maybe I'm undervaluing Cole from this perspective, for Gerrit Cole, it's a home run issue. But in a world where your average starting pitcher is throwing like 170 to 180 innings instead of getting up to 200, like, their opportunity to put up elite value is just lower, and it's riskier, and there's going to be more variability in their performance and more possibility of injury and all sorts of other stuff that for me keeps their value down, and I am more likely to spend on hitters. And that's why I've got, you know, my top 20 has one pitcher in it, unless you count Otani, which you shouldn't. It's Strider, right? Strider is the only pitcher in my top 20. I can make a case that that's not fair and I should have more pitchers up there, but I'm not going over $35 for any of the other pitchers. So they don't get into those tiers. So that's just sort of how it it plays out. So I agree. It looked weird to me too. Like, I went over this like multiple times being like, there shouldn't be one pitcher in my top three tiers combined. That doesn't seem right. But then I'm like, oh, the prices on these guys seem like the prices I'm comfortable with. And so I just couldn't do it. But,
and that underscores the point of being opportunistic within a tier, right? Yeah. Because, like, okay, you know, I might not feel comfortable paying 28 to 35 for any pitcher not named, you know, Spencer Strider, but I want one of them. So I'm going to try to find which one goes under 30 and they can still meet that tier and I'll feel pretty good about the price.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I do think, you know, in my existing leagues where I'm, you know, it's going to be very different, right? If I need pitching and these are the guys who are out there, like there's two of those guys out there, I'm just going to pay for one of them if I have to.
Yeah.
Like,
it's probably going to hurt, but yeah, that's what you got to do.
I'm not going to be real happy about it, but like, yeah, it's what you got to do. The last thing I want to talk about with these rankings, I have Shohei Ohtani fifth. There are two things for me that go into ranking him that high. One is he was an elite offensive performer last year, right? Now he is util only. That obviously hurts at least a little bit, but like, you know, if I'm going to plug somebody into my util spot, like he's as good a hitter to have to build around as any. On top of that, there is future value there because I think we still assume he's going to come back and pitch. And that won't be this year, but if I can get him in that range, right? He is fifth of the six guys in that top tier. I have him right ahead of Yordan, right behind Mookie. And I think for me, what this came down to, and I was like, if I was picking between Alvarez and Ohtani for this year alone, I'd probably take Yordan. They're both elite hitters. They're both going to put up great numbers, but one of them has outfield eligibility. That makes a big difference. I that's probably where I would go. But if those two guys, if you tell me right now, those two guys are going to be the same price, I would take Ohtani because I'll be able to keep him next year as my util slash ace. And that has value.
For sure. The one thing I would say, and I want to start by saying I agree with what you just said. But the one thing I would say is, in Anu, I think being util only is worse than it normally is in, say, your average roto league. And that is because of the less positions. And it's really just one, right? There's one less position because you still have middle infield, but you do not have corner infield on your roster. And like that is visibly hurting me in the staff league. Where, for example, I have Marcell Ozuna for $3 next year. That should be slam dunk bankable value. And that's important for my roster to go forward. Like, even after a first year auction, those values I feel like are even more valuable because you can get players like that at super cheap deals. And Ozuna for $3 feels like awesome, perfect. This is a player that's going to allow me to do other things with my roster. Except when you factor in that I have Tristan Cassis at $11, which is another slam dunk deal, and Freddie Freeman for $50. I cannot play all three of those players at the same time, right? And you could just say, well, cut Freeman, save all that money, invest it elsewhere. But I don't know. I don't really want to cut Freddie Freeman. I feel like that's a pretty good player for $50. So until only, I do think it hurts more than in other formats just because the rosters are a little bit smaller and because it is still five outfielders. Outfielders are very important to me. So I'm not saying I wouldn't pay for Ohtani or that he's not the fifth player. It's just understand going for those util only guys. It hurts a little bit more than it normally does. It's not like getting JD Martinez late in a roto league and being like, oh, I had util open anyway. Now I got this 30 home run hitter. It doesn't always work that way in Ohtani. And I'm trying to navigate that myself right now.
Yeah. And I think that there's a roster construction question there. I think in a first year league, the good thing is you can just plan around that, right?
Like, right.
Just don't spend $50 on Freeman and $15 on Cassis and $55 on Ohtani. Like, That's a manageable thing in a first year league. I agree. When you've got an existing roster, like, you have to figure out the right way to work around the challenge that puts on you. But like last year, the top points per game hitter in Fangraphs points was Acuna at 9.11. Otani was second at 8.79. Nobody else was over 8.5. Seager was third at 8.31. Betts 8.14. Freeman 8.1. Those were the only five guys over 8. Like, he is an elite hitter in this format. And I think, honestly, like, even in drafts, even in other formats, I think people are sort of sleeping on him a little bit.
Now is the time to buy.
Weird thing to say. Agreed. Yeah. But I think people are like, oh, well, he's not going to be what he was and he's hurt and blah, blah. It's like, yeah, but he's going to should be fine to DH. And man, I think now is the time. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right that if you have to deal with that util only thing on an existing roster, you have to figure out what to do with him in a startup league. I think if you're going to target him, just be aware that you're going to target him and don't go out and spend a bunch of money on another, like, multiple corner infielders. If that's your plan. Yeah. In that staff league, you could just trade me Cassis and that would solve your problem.
Well, I have a whole other problem there with, because there's only one, you know, middle infield spot or whatever it might be. Not that there should be more. I've got all sorts of issues there. CJ Abrams is on my bench right now. It's just less valuable in this format, but a $7 CJ Abrams makes me happy, and he's on my bench with a $3 Ozuna and a $3 burger. I just want to get these guys in.
Yeah, those aren't bad guys to have on your bench, though. Like,
no, it's a good problem to have.
You'll have opportunities to get them into the lineup. Guys will get hurt, right? Like, it'll come up. And you and I, look, we have talked about Cassis. I am definitely interested in him. And the challenge that we're running into, to the same point, is we have a $35 Olson and a $31 Alonso. And so, like, we've talked about a deal for Cassis that I'm not sure I want to do anyways, but I can't do it now. Like, they just, sure, there's no reason for me to do it right now. And so we're actually, Niv and I are having some trade talks about Alonso and Olson to figure out what we're going to do, because we are interested in Cassis and you do need to make a move. So there may be a fit there if we can find a way to make it work, but we'll see.
I'll keep looking.
But with that, we are at time. I think we've been going for over an hour now, covered a lot of stuff around first year auctions, auto new values. I got some feedback on my rankings, which will help, because I'm going to start publishing those soon ish. But yeah, thank you all for listening. We'll be back with you in 2 weeks.